You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 275, Exodus 13. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike. This week, so, we're back into Exodus.
Yep. Yes, we are. At least, you know, we're going to hit Exodus 13, at least parts of it. So we're going to focus on Exodus 13, the first two verses, and then verses 11 through 16. And we are going to, believe it or not, I'm going to get into a dissertation here that, again, I can't post somebody's dissertation online, but a lot of good stuff in these things, and this will be a good sort of illustrative episode as to, you know, why that stuff's important. Now, you know, Exodus 12, which we went through not too long ago, was, of course, the institution of the Passover. So you get Exodus 12 and the Passover, and then you hit chapter 13, and you get these first two verses. I'm going to read them. The Lord said unto Moses, consecrate to me all the firstborn, whatever is the first to open the womb among the people of Israel, both man and of beast, is mine. So there's a connection here because there's a reference to the firstborn, and of course, Passover comes on the heels or in connection with the last plague, which is the death of the firstborn. And the Passover was that protection offering. If you're not familiar with that term for Pesach, the verb for that's behind the noun Pesach, Passover, you can go listen to the old episode a couple episodes ago. But the sacrifice of the Passover lamb was about protecting the ones who did it and then, you know, put the blood on the doorpost and the lintel of their homes. So there's a connection between the idea of the firstborn either dying or, and this is important for this episode, or being protected, and chapter 13, this consecration of the firstborn. Now, you hit those first two verses, you know, consecrate to me the firstborn, whatever is first to open the womb is mine, of man and beast. And then you get this, what feels like an intrusion in verses 3 through 10. It's the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You know, listeners might recall a few episodes ago, I mentioned that these feasts get connected in the Hebrew Bible. There was, you know, some sort of difference between them or separation, or, you know, there's a development of thought here, or at least probably a better way to put it, a development of portrayal. But it's not really an intrusion because if you're going to connect the Feast of Unleavened Bread with the Passover, then it's not too interruptive to start talking about the Feast of Unleavened Bread here in connection with the consecration of the firstborn, because the context for that is the Passover. But I mention that to say, you know, I'm hoping you're getting a feel for how, when you read through not just Exodus, but different portions of the Bible, it just seems like the writers will at times skip from one thing to the next. And in some cases, you got to really pay attention to discern any connection between the sections. And sometimes you do have true intrusions, and you know, there could be literary reasons for that. But this is one of these instances where it feels like an intrusion. But okay, you know, there is a way to connect these things. And then you hit verse 11. So let me read verses 11 through 16. And this isn't going to take us to the end of the chapter, because after verse 16, then you get the pillar of cloud and fire. Now that feels much more intrusive because we're not even into the Exodus itinerary yet. But up until this point, again, you can see the conceptual connections. So here's verses 11 through 16. When the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers and shall give it to you, you shall set apart to the Lord all that first opens the womb. So this is hearkening back to verses 1 and 2 about consecrating the firstborn, continuing in Exodus 3 verse, or Exodus 13 verse 12. So set apart to the Lord all that first opens the womb, all the firstborn of your animals that are males shall be the Lord's. Every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. We're going to come back to that a couple times. Or if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. Every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. And when in time to come your son asks you, what does this mean? You shall say to him, by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. For when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animals. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all the males that first opened the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be as a mark on your head or frontlets between your eyes, for by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. So that's verses 11 to 16. You say, well, what's the big deal, you know, with this firstborn stuff, you know, connected to the Passover? Well, there's actually a fairly active controversy here. There are certain scholars that argue that the passage, specifically Exodus 13, the first two verses, and then verses 11 through 16, that these verses are to be taken literally, that Yahweh demanded the Israelites to sacrifice their firstborn male child. In other words, human sacrifice. And they further argue, you know, certain scholars, that this happened in Israel and it was part of orthodox, normative worship of Yahweh. In other words, it wasn't an abomination or an aberration back in the days of Moses and Joshua, you know, the early days of Israel. Now, in particular, you know, this thing has gone back and forth, you know, this controversy. And in 2004, there was a book that came out. Now, this book has not been reviewed much in scholarly circles, but the author, you know, for whatever reason, the author has sort of been one of these scholars that kind of gets into the public eye, you know, through what I pejoratively referred to as archaeoporn, you know, because of the you know, sort of sensational or salacious aspects of this topic. You know, people will find her, and then, you know, this particular scholar, and then it's big news about how, you know, the Old Testament advocates, you know, human sacrifice or something like that, you know, archaeoporn. So the scholar's name is Francesca Stavrakopoulou, and her book is entitled King Manasseh and Child Sacrifice, subtitle, Biblical Distortions of Historical Realities. It's a 2004 book. You know, it's a scholarly publication. I think De Gruyter is the publisher. So, you know, her work in 2004, you know, sort of is the latest iteration, or at least in the public eye, the latest iteration of this whole controversy. Does Exodus 13 teach that, you know, Yahweh wanted the Israelites to offer their firstborn children to, you know, as some sort of commemoration of what happened at Passover? Now, as you hear me say that, the red light should go off on your head, you know, that how in the world does that make any sense? And I'd agree. You know, you might ask, well, how can anyone argue this point given what we just read in verses 11 through 16? It's clear that there's provision here to not, you know, offer the child as a sacrifice, okay? In verse 13, every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. In other words, you can substitute, you know, something else for it. You know, you don't have to, the point is not that you have to kill your firstborn child, but you go through this ritual act, you know, as some sort of, you know, commemorative thing, you know, just to remind you of the firstborn and the cost of the Passover and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, there's a provision there to not kill the children. And it even says when your son asks you, hey, why are we doing this? Well, you know, you tell him the story of the Passover, and this is why, you know, we sacrifice the animals, but we don't sacrifice the children, because the Lord redeemed us. You know, the Lord took us out of Egypt, the realm of death, as it were. And as a substitute, we had a lamb back at Passover. And of course, Israelites would be observing the Passover. But since it was the firstborn, you know, this is another, you know, part of the ritual remembrance of what happened at Passover. So you would think, well, it's clear that they're not doing this. They're not sacrificing their children. And it's clear from verses 11 through 16 that they don't have to. So why would anybody argue this? And not only that, but it makes little sense to commemorate the deliverance of your firstborn child by Yahweh's protection. Again, the Pesach, to protect the Pesach sacrifice, you know, of the lamb in Egypt. The whole idea of Passover was to commemorate deliverance. Why would you commemorate deliverance of your firstborn child by killing it? It just makes zero sense. It's just kind of a bizarre thought pattern. Let's kill what Yahweh spared because he wants us to kill it now. Again, it just doesn't make any sense. So you'd ask, well, why would anybody think this? And I'm going to go through the logic and the argumentation of why this sort of thing is argued. And you're going to see some patterns here. And I'm going to sort of overview it, for this next part of the episode. Then I want to sort of drill down a little bit on Stavrakopoulou's work, because again, she's the one that has sort of been in the public eye in this regard, at least for this topic in recent memory. So the logic and argumentation for this is as follows. This is how, certain scholars, not by no means, the majority. It's a small number, but they do it. And again, by virtue of the nature of the topic, it does get attention from time to time, sort of out in the populace. So the first argument would be, well, verses 11 through 16 of Exodus 13 were added later. They weren't there originally. They were just added later. A later time when Israelite religion had moved beyond child sacrifice, it has some moment of enlightenment. Hey, we shouldn't be killing our kids, And so then some scribe comes along and says, well, there's that stuff in the Torah, those first two verses of Exodus 13, and so I'll fix that. I'll add some verses, and then we'll be okay. And you say, that's kind of artificial and self-serving. I would agree. But this is how the argument is made, and it's how it's been made for quite a long time now. This goes back to Eisfeld, Otto Eisfeld, who's, famous for, as a source, critic, the JEDP stuff. And other things too. He was a Old Testament scholar of some time ago. Eisfeld's views are sort of representative. Now, there's an article by Hatting, Hattingh, and Meyer, Meyer, that provide a short literature review of this issue. And they start with Eisfeld because everybody does. Their article is entitled "Devoted to Destruction: A Case of Human Sacrifice in Leviticus 27?" Question mark. So they're actually talking about a different passage, Leviticus 27, but in so doing, they are going to overview the history of this question, and I think their article is pretty useful for that. So I'll quote a portion here, and I'll pick up a few other things with their article, but again, it's a pretty useful overview. They write, Eisfeld, in 1935, also provides a broad overview of how he thinks the ideas around child sacrifice developed. In essence, it was portrayed in a positive light before the Deuteronomic Reform. Let me just stop there. The Deuteronomic Reform, when you see that in biblical scholarship, that is a reference to the time of King Josiah of Judah, roughly 640 to 609 BC. It was during Josiah's reign that he started getting rid of idolatry in a big way, and he made a concerted effort, to get rid of certain practices. And it was also, that's also the time when the Book of the Law was discovered. Now, classic critical scholarship says the Book of the Law that was quote unquote discovered was Deuteronomy, and people, are kind of across the confessional board, across the scholarly board, spectrum they're fine with saying it's Deuteronomy, but a lot, I would say in this case, it is fair to say most critical biblical scholars would say that Deuteronomy wasn't discovered. It was written during this time. This is its point of origin. And they would use this sort of assumption to, say that basically they're going to argue that the entire thing was written at this time or later, as opposed to someone like a supplementarian, who would say, well, some of it might have been early, Mosaic, and then some, it gets added to later, that kind of thing. But they're going to argue this because there are certain changes in laws in Deuteronomy from Exodus, and that it is helpful in certain cases to explain the differences against the backdrop of the horrors of idolatry. So because again, that's a good approach in certain passages. It's very common that people will presume that the discovery by Hilkiah the priest of Deuteronomy is not a discovery at all. It's sort of biblical code for the priests writing it at this time. So again, Deuteronomic reform. Let's go back to Eisfeld. He says, before we had this Deuteronomic thing happen, before the time of Josiah, child sacrifice was viewed positively. But things changed after this reform, and later authors did everything in their power to put more distance between this embarrassing act and the cult of Yahweh, the worship of Yahweh, and projected it onto Canaanite religion. So the whole notion, you know, that, and you'll see this in you know, the books of, you know, Kings and in the prophets, essentially linking this practice to foreign cults, you know, Canaanite cults. There are a number of scholars, Eisfeld among them, would say, you know, this wasn't the problem of the foreign, you know, pagans. This was an Israelite problem. And so when they start addressing it in the evolution of their religion, they just start blaming the Canaanites. So this is, again, the sort of, I think, the major trajectory of how this is argued, this notion that the original worship of Yahweh at one time had human sacrifice. And again, if you object to the verses 11 through 16, they're just going to say, oh, those were added later. And you say, well, that's just an assumption, and you would be correct. There's no empirical data that prove that verses 11 through 16 were added later. I'm just telling you this is how it's argued. Well, that stuff's later. Because look at the assumption here, that Israelite religion, like, you know, lots of other religions, sort of in an anthropological approach, that it evolves, it becomes more enlightened. Okay, so that's the underlying assumption here. And so when you have passages like verses 11 through 16 that soften or do away with or object to, like, no, it's not, you don't really literally offer your firstborn. They'll say, oh, that's later, after Israelite religion had evolved to a certain point. So there's an evolutionary assumption that goes hand in hand with this. Secondly, they'll argue that commands in the Old Testament elsewhere, you know, outside of Exodus 13 here, from the same presumed time period of the alleged later edition of verses 11 through 16, rail against child sacrifice. And they would say, well, that means it was happening. You wouldn't have the prophets rail against it unless it was happening. Well, that's pretty logical. I would say, yes, if it was a problem and the prophets rail against it, I mean, they wouldn't be railing against something that didn't happen. So I get that. But now here's the added thought. That means it was happening. And so therefore, that also means it was legitimate at one time. Again, that, folks, is what we call a non sequitur, a conclusion that does not necessarily follow. But again, my point here is this is how the idea is argued. You know, so you get those two ideas. And again, I'm hoping you see that there are some logical leaps here. It's pure speculation that verses 11 through 16 are later than verses 1 and 2. Even in standard JEDP studies, you know, about the authorship of the Torah, they don't, you know, you can find plenty of them that do not divide up the text that way, that attribute verses 11 through 16, you know, wholesale as, you know, some later source. So I don't know if I want to call it idiosyncratic. I will, it's a bit idiosyncratic, but it makes sense, quote unquote, to critical scholars because they presuppose the evolutionary development of Israelite religion from something primitive to something more enlightened. But again, it's pure speculation that one set of verses was added after the other, after the first two. Secondly, you know, there's a logical leap here because verse 13 allows for the redemption of a firstborn donkey. Let me read it to you. Every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. Or if you will not redeem it, then break its neck. You know, then do away with it or sacrifice it or whatever. So by using this logic, the critical logic, did that mean that the prophets had some problem with sacrificing firstborn donkeys? So that when the guy added verses 11 through 16, he was also offended by letting donkeys off the hook, or he wanted donkeys off the hook, and so he put the firstborn donkey line in there as also evidence that they had evolved in their thinking. Like, what? I mean, how does that make any sense? You know, Durham, in his Exodus commentary, in the word biblical commentary, says here, the animal, again, the firstborn donkey, could be ransomed or replaced, the Hebrew is padah, by a flock animal, or it could be destroyed. In other words, not, and he has in parentheses, not sacrificed, but just destroyed. And he takes note that the breaking of the neck isn't a sacrificial act here. The firstborn human male was to be replaced, but at what cost? The text doesn't say. You know, it just says you redeem it. And he says, neither does Exodus 34:20. Let me read you that verse. The firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb, or you will not redeem it. Or if you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. All the firstborn of your son shall, or you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. So it actually occurs in another place in Exodus. But again, the logic, if you say somebody's adding these verses because they're more enlightened, you know, and they add them because the practice of child sacrifice was so offensive by now. They had evolved, you know, to the point where they're offended by this now. Well, then I guess they had evolved to the point where redeeming firstborn donkeys is necessary too, that somehow that offended them as well. What you'll typically see, and again, you know, it's interesting, even in the dissertation I'll quote later, which evaluates Stavrakopoulos' work in one section of it, even that person misses this detail, the firstborn donkey. I mean, again, the logic just doesn't work, but it's just this one line in verse 13 that often gets missed, but it mars the logic of how this view, how this idea is put forth. Another thing I could say is some would argue in response that the passage lets the matter up to parents. Now, Stavrakopoulos actually does argue this. In other words, you know, she and others would say, well, look, you know, people who had verses 11 through 16, whenever that was added later, okay, they could still sacrifice their kid if they wanted to. But if they didn't, well, then they could redeem it. So it doesn't, like, you know, totally do away, you know, with the child sacrifice. It just gives them the option. They could, if they chose, offer their firstborn male child to Yahweh, or they could redeem it. Now, here's a good question. Let me suggest this question. Do we ever see this happening in the Hebrew Bible? And the answer would be no, we don't. So this actually amounts to an argument from silence, or even an argument from circular reasoning. And I'll try to explain it just briefly here. So we're told that verses 11 through 16 were added later during some zealous monotheistic spasm, you know, like the religious reforms, you know, during the time of Josiah. Okay. And this also coincides the time of some of Israel's prophets. Okay. The era of the Deuteronomic legislation, or, you know, the Deuteronomistic period. We're further told that the various passages in the prophets that condemn child sacrifice come from the same sources and period, the prophets at the same time period. So consequently, so the conclusion goes, the prophets were trying to eradicate this practice, a practice that was legitimized by Exodus 13, 1 through 2. The solution was preaching against it and adding to the Torah, adding verses 11 through 16. That sounds like a neat picture, but there's one essential item missing. There isn't a single passage that endorses child sacrifice in the Hebrew Bible. There's your argument from silence. They assume that the practice was endorsed by Exodus 13, 1 through 2, but to make Exodus 13, 1 through 2 an endorsement, you have to eliminate verses 11 through 16 to a later period. You know, that's also circular reasoning. You know, what, you know, you might say, well, hey, you know, Exodus 13, 1 through 2 is an endorsement there. Well, in logic, that's called assuming what you need to prove. It goes something like this. Yeah, I'm going to pretend I'm a promoter of this idea now. You know, my argument that Exodus 13, 1 through 2 calls for child sacrifice is legitimate because verses 11 through 16 were added. And we know that they were added because Exodus 13, 1 and 2 affirms the practice. See that neat circle I just argued? That's circular reasoning. Okay, you can't use your assumption as proof to argue in favor of your assumption. You don't use an assumption as proof of your assumption. And all you have is the assumption. You need some other passage that illustrates the practice of child sacrifice, that it was occurring and that Yahweh was pleased with it. If you find that, then your take on Exodus 13, 1 through 2 becomes coherent. And then, in turn, your idea about the lateness of verses 11 through 16 would also become coherent. But as it stands, you have circular reasoning. Now, the approach also assumes, you know, we're talking here about logical jumps here. The approach also assumes that if a practice existed, it must have been approved, especially if it was condemned by the prophets. That, folks, in logic, is again what we call a non sequitur. And it's sort of akin to the Yahweh's wife thinking. And I don't know if I want to get into that or not, but you know, you could say it like this. Of course, child sacrifice occurred in Israel. The prophets are condemning it. It's happening. It's going on. But why would the fact that it happens mean that it was legitimate early in Israel's history? Why? Now, I think it's worth pointing out that my skepticism here and rejection of the idea that Exodus 13, 1 and 2 is within the scholarly mainstream. This isn't just me. This is not something tied to evangelicalism or some other confessional commitment. For instance, I'm going to quote Mark Smith here. Mark's essay, Child Sacrifice as the Extreme Case and Calculation. And it comes from the book entitled Not Sparing the Child, subtitle Human Sacrifice in the Ancient World and Beyond, Studies in Honor of Professor Paul G. Mosca. Mosca's done a lot of work in this area. He did a lot of work on Molech. I'm going to quote from Smith here. Again, Smith is not an evangelical. He's a Catholic, but he's not an evangelical. And he's about as mainstream in biblical scholarship as you can get. Smith writes this. The references to child sacrifice in, for example, 2 Kings 16:3 and 21:6 likewise represent extremity. In these cases, the outer limits of idolatry. Both verses are intriguing for their brevity and perspective. 2 Kings 16:3 attributes to Ahaz the sacrifice of his son in a clause opening with Hebrew vegam and also. Elsewhere in the narrative sections of 2 Kings, this construction marks material layered into accounts, either to express condemnation, for example, 2 Kings 13:6, 21:16, or to note action taken against condemnable practices, 2 Kings 23:15 and verse 19 and verse 24. The report in 2 Kings 16:3 then offers a comparison, quote, like the abomination of the nations. That's what it compares child sacrifice to. I'll just read the verse. He walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He even burned his son as an offering, according to the despicable practices of the nations, whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. So back to Smith. Smith saying, well, you know, we have this comparison here. Here the practice is marked as the outer limits of immoral behavior, being associated with other nations by the implied narrator. In this way, this traditional practice is represented as the extreme measure of Ahaz's idolatrous behavior. The context for the practice is not supplied, although 2 Kings 16:5 refers to the siege of Jerusalem. Quote, they besieged Ahaz and they were unable in battling, unquote. It would be tempting, Smith says, to connect the report of a child sacrifice with the siege, but this oversteps the evidence. More to the point, the report of the practice charges King Ahaz with the worst behaviors associated by this narrator with foreign nations. This is historiography as sermon. The similar formulation for child sacrifice in 2 Kings 21:6 belongs to a long catalog of Manasseh's sins, where in 2 Kings 16:3, child sacrifice heads the characterization of Ahaz's sin. In Manasseh's case, 2 Kings 21:6, it is one item in a longer laundry list of idolatrous acts. And then Smith concludes, in 2 Kings 16:3 and 21:6, child sacrifice is represented as a foreign practice wholly unbefitting of Israel's kings. These passages represent the practice as the extreme case of immoral non-Israelite behavior. End of the section. So now, again, this is where most scholars are at. They're going to say, look, it happened. It's idolatrous. They will trace it to, again, things outside Israel that are brought in terms of apostate religion, you know, on the part of certain kings. this is where the mainstream is still at. But again, you get scholars sort of, you know, on the periphery here, or at least, you know, their views on this are, you know, more minority. And again, we're talking about how in the world they argue this. Condemnations are later than Exodus 13, 1 through 2, which is our launching point for this episode. You know, they'll argue, again, I think pretty demonstrably in a circle, you know, to do this. They'll assume that a practice certainly was accepted, especially when it was condemned by the prophets. The prophets are later. Well, why would they think that way? Because they have this evolutionary mindset. You know, Israelite religion evolved from something primitive and icky to something enlightened. Okay? So this is, again, how the idea is articulated. Now, you might guess there are bigger issues behind all of this. It's tied to the controversy or difficulty of the nature of the MLK sacrifice, which is variously, you have to remember Hebrew and Semitic languages, they didn't have vowels, okay? So you're dealing with consonants here. So MLK in Hebrew and broader Semitic languages can mean a few things. It could be the word for king. It could be the consonants that form the name of a deity like Molech. It could be the reference to a sacrifice, a Molch sacrifice. So there's a problem with knowing at any given text which one of those things is in mind or an admixture of some. And so that the controversy over this extends into this area. And I'm going to try to unpack this for you. So that, you know, when these sorts of things, these MLK events, okay, Molch sacrifices or whatever, these MLK consonants, okay, I'll say events, these MLK events, when you see them happen in the Hebrew Bible, the difficulty is, are we talking about a deity or are we talking about a sacrifice or something else, or again, some mix between the two? So the terminology, what that means is that the terminology may not refer to a deity. It may not refer to Molech. Some of these passages may not be talking about Molech, and it may not even be talking about a sacrifice, a child sacrifice from Molech religion. It could be talking about some other kind of sacrifice. So there, this is where the battleground really gets to. How do we understand these MLK events or sacrifices? So I'm going to read from Hatting and Meyer's Literature Review again. This is a more extensive portion because they go through this this issue. So you'll get a broad overview here of the problems and of the issues that are part of this discussion. They write, any discussion on human sacrifice in the Hebrew Bible at some point touches on Molech. Over 80 years ago, Otto Eisfeld, again, 1935, discussed Molech and child sacrifice. He started his argument by examining the phenomenon in the Phoenician Punic sphere, but also provided an overview of how he thinks child sacrifice developed in ancient Israel. Eisfeld argued that in Punic, Molech, actually M-O-L-K, is how it would be vocalized, was a sacrificial term and not the name of a deity. For Eisfeld, Molch was initially also a sacrificial term in ancient Israel, similar to the one in Punic texts, which was eventually changed to the name of a deity. Eisfeld believes that the motives behind this change could be found in the Deuteronomic reform of Josiah, and he understands later texts as an attempt to distantiate the sacrifice of children from the Yahweh cult by changing the meaning of the term to the name of a god, a foreign god. Let me stop there. So what Eisfeld argued is that, look, hey, we got this term here in Phoenician, this MLK event, and we got some of these happen in the Hebrew Bible. And, you know, in the Phoenician stuff, you know, it has to do with Molech. But Eisfeld thought, yeah, you know what? I think that in ancient Israel, they were essentially doing the same sacrifice, because the same term is used, the same sacrifice, and it was legit. It was okay. You could kill your kid. But then in the Deuteronomic reform, when Israel reached this new level of enlightenment, you know, the priest, whoever is, you know, fiddling with the text or, again, writing Deuteronomy at this point or whatever they're writing, whatever they're adding or writing, they decided to point the text in a certain way so that you would think that this is a foreign sacrifice, something associated with Molech, the deity. And that way, they basically covered their butts. they distracted attention away from the idea that this used to be part of ancient Israel's worship, child sacrifice. And so that their readers would think, oh, this is the bad guy, Molech. That's where this comes from. Okay, that is the hermeneutic of suspicion in full display for you, right there. There's no empirical evidence that will point to what I just sketched out. That is taking the data and assembling the data in such a way, in other words, you're interpreting the data. It's your interpretation of the data, but there's nothing about the data themselves that compel that reconstruction. But that was Eisfeld's reconstruction. And again, I do think it's a good illustration of the hermeneutic of suspicion. Something's condemned in the Hebrew Bible, that must mean it was okay before. Again, logic, please. Can we have rules of logic that everyone sort of understands and operates by? Can we do that? Okay, back to the Hatting and Meyer overview. They write, before Eisfeld, the interpreters of Punic inscriptions had read the MLK references either as the name of a deity or as a title, King, capital K. In either case, referring to the divine recipient of the offering commemorated by the inscription. That was Heider's view. In 1972, 37 years after Eisfeld, Moshe Weinfeld engaged with Eisfeld's material and reached different conclusions with regard to most of Eisfeld's arguments on Molech. Where Eisfeld thought that child sacrifice happened in ancient Israel, Weinfeld argued that, quote, making to pass through the fire, unquote, meant passing through or between rows of flames as a means of purification and dedication. Thus, Weinfeld thought that the burning of children should not be taken literally, but rather figuratively, as it denotes dedication to the idolatrous priesthood. At the beginning of Weinfeld's article, he makes an important, quote-unquote, methodological comment, which we, Hatting and Meyer here, which we think is important to keep in mind. And then they quote Weinfeld, who said, in discussion on human sacrifices, a distinction has to be made between a sacrifice which, proceeding from an extraordinary situation, a crisis, calamity, and so on, occurs only rarely and at infrequent intervals, and by contrast, a human sacrifice as a fixed institution. That's the end of Weinfeld's quote in the Hatting and Meyer article. So basically, they're pointing out that Weinfeld said, hey, look, there's a difference here between this happening in some sort of reactionary panic kind of thing, some crisis, and it being a normal institution. Those are two different things. Now back to their article. They write, this seems to imply that Weinfeld does not question the fact that under extraordinary circumstances, adults or children might have been sacrificed to Yahweh. It also implies that Weinfeld actually saw some link between sacrifice and it's a Hebrew term, sarech, a debate which we will engage with later. Okay, we're not doing Leviticus 27, so we're not going to worry about that. They continue, yet he, Weinfeld, takes serious exception to the idea that human sacrifice might have been a fixed institution in ancient Israel. You know, Weinfeld just didn't believe that. In the 1980s, they continue, two scholars revisited the issue of Molech and consequently human sacrifice. First, George Heider, 1985. Produced a study on Molech, concluding that Molech was the name of a god and not a sacrificial term, as suggested by Eisfeld. Yet Heider agrees with Eisfeld that the cult, quote, was licit, in other words, it was allowed, in Israel until Josiah's reform, unquote, and that it actually involved sacrificing children. Heider also disagrees with Eisfeld in arguing that the cult of Molech is probably Canaanite and not Israelite, or could even be regarded as Phoenician, but was not part of the Yahweh cult. Later, John Day, 1989, concluded that child sacrifice did occur in the Canaanite world, and he sees no reason to doubt the Hebrew Bible's allusion to human sacrifice as actual physical sacrifices. Day agrees with Heider that child sacrifice, as presented in the Hebrew Bible, was practiced in ancient Israel. Like Heider, Day also thinks that Molech possibly refers to a Canaanite god and disagrees strongly with Eisfeld in this regard. More recently, Francesca Stavrakopoulou has been the most vocal on the issue of child sacrifice. Stavrakopoulou, 2004, agrees with Heider and Day that child sacrifice was practiced in ancient Israel, but she also agrees with Eisfeld that originally the term Molech was probably a sacrificial term, the MLK term. Stavrakopoulou actually argues there was possibly three different kinds of child sacrifice, namely a firstborn sacrifice, the MLK sacrifice, and the sacrifice to the Shaddai gods. Now, I'm going to break in here. The Shaddai gods is a reference to the Deir Allah text. It's a text that's famous, you know, for its connection with the Balaam account. We're not going to be drilling down there, but it has the term Shaddai in that text. It's Aramaic, and that is a cognate to Shadim, which is the term, you know, for territorial deity in Deuteronomy 32:17. So the reason I bring it up is, if you take Deuteronomy 32:17, the Shadim there as the Shaddaiin, well, Deuteronomy 32 presents the sacrifices there as an aberration. In other words, this was not allowed. This was not a positive, licit institution in Israel. Again, if you take Deuteronomy 32 there. But again, people say, oh, it's so much later, you know, blah, 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 you know, so on and so forth. Despite the fact that Deuteronomy 32, if you look at the study by Paul Sanders, which is the most thorough to date, there's a good bit of that that is demonstrably linguistically earlier, let's just put it this way, you know, earlier than you would think the enlightened Deuteronomic reform would be. But anyway, this is getting too far afield. But I just wanted you to note that there's a connection here between the gods of the nations, the sacrifices to them, and this whole issue. Now, most of these cults, this is back to Hatting and Meyer. Most of these cults, talking about Stavrakopoulou's view, she says, were initially associated with Yahweh worship, an argument which has a lot in common with Eisfeld's original study, and hence in this regard she differs from Heider and Day. And then he quotes they quote Stavrakopoulou, just a little bit, I'll read it to you. This discussion has argued that the biblical portrayal of child sacrifice as a foreign practice is historically unreliable. So she just says the biblical data are just unreliable here, the way they're presented. It has been suggested that child sacrifice is instead better understood as a native and normative element of Judahite religious practice, including Yahweh worship, unquote. So that's just a little portion from the Stavrakopoulou. Now back to Hatting and Meyer. This quote is from a chapter by Stavrakopoulou on the, quote, distortion of child sacrifice, in which she argues that although it was initially part of Yahweh worship, most biblical texts portray it as a foreign practice. She just disagrees that that's legit. She thinks that's propaganda on the part of the biblical writers. Now, in regard to that, that'll be the end of my, you know, quotation of Hatting and Meyer. But in regard to their study, their article was about Leviticus 27, 28, and 29. I'll just read you the two verses because you might be curious here. But no devoted thing that a man devotes to the Lord of anything that he has, whether man or beast or of his inherited field, shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted thing is most holy to the Lord. No one devoted who is to be devoted for destruction from mankind shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. So devoted to the Lord is the word cherem. This is the verb of destruction for the conquest. And so that last line is sort of the issue. You know, people who are supposed to be devoted to destruction shall be ransomed. In other words, you can't redeem them. They have to be put to death. That's Leviticus 27, 28, and 29. That's the comment. So their article was about that passage, but there's no way to prove, as they admit in the article, that what's referred to in Leviticus 27 and 28, or 27, 28, and 29, there's no way to prove that that passage was about a sacrifice, like a ritual event, as opposed to like a death penalty requirement. You know, one can see these verses as applying to Exodus 22:20, for example. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be devoted to destruction. Like, there's actually a law in the Torah that if somebody, you know, if you see somebody, you know, offering to some other god, then that's a death penalty offense. So Leviticus 27 and 28 and 29, you know, could be referring to that kind of situation. There's no way to know or to prove that it's like a religious ritual, you know, like in terms of an institution in ancient Israel. It could very well just be you committed a capital offense, you have to die now, and there's no possibility of your redemption. This is a death penalty offense, sacrificing to some other god. So, you know, in theory, you could have a member of your household, maybe your wife or a servant or something, somebody in your extended family, you catch them offering a sacrifice to another god, That's a death penalty offense. So that could very well be what Leviticus 27 is talking about. And the authors recognize that. It's conceivable, again, that maybe it also applies, not just somebody in your household doing this, you know, committing the offense of Exodus 22:20. But we know from the book of Judges, for instance, that instead of driving all of the people out, okay, and again, I my position is that the rationale for this, you know, was the targeting of the giant clans here. Nevertheless, you know, you're going to have people in these places that get caught up in this and they die in the conquest. And we learn from the book of Judges that there was intermarriage going on with these people. They didn't drive them all out. I mean, they don't necessarily have to kill them. You know, again, if, as I talked about, an unseen realm, there are other verbs besides destruction verbs in the conquest narrative, but you certainly weren't supposed to intermarry with them. And so it's also conceivable that Exodus 22:20, that might be derivative of this problem. You know, later on they intermarry and one of these people sacrifices to a foreign god. There you go. It's a death penalty offense. You know, there's any number of ways where you could come up with a scenario that sort of lurks behind Leviticus 27 and, of course, Exodus 22. But, you know, Stavrakopoulou isn't thinking along those trajectories. She's thinking along different trajectories. It's clear, again, she's operating from something of a hermeneutic of suspicion. She wants to, for some reason, exonerate Manasseh and simply asserts that the biblical writers are engaging in propaganda to cover up the fact that child sacrifice was once part of Yahweh worship. Now, Hatting and Meyer's literature review, as good as it is, and I think they're, let me go back up and let me just flip over and just find the date of that. I know I just gave it to you, but I want to find the reference here. That was 2016. Okay, their article is 2016. As good as their literature review is, it does not include a recent dissertation. This is a Johns Hopkins University dissertation. But that isn't unusual. You know, published articles usually cover published literature. So whether they were aware of this dissertation or not, I don't know. But the dissertation was by Heath Durell. It's Dewrell. And it's entitled Child Sacrifice in Ancient Israel and Its Opponents. It's Johns Hopkins PhD dissertation from 2012. Now, it has since been published by Eisenbrons, so you could actually buy this. It's a hardback book. If you have access to the dissertation databases, you might as well just get it, you know, there for free. But anyway, it has been published. Now, Durell's thoughts, I've gone through this dissertation in regard, you know, to this topic, obviously. And I'm just going to read a few things that he has, a few comments that he has, because this is to date the most recent work on this issue. And again, this is Johns Hopkins. It's a PhD dissertation. This isn't a hack job. This is real scholarship. Not that the other ones aren't, but this is real scholarship too. So page 59 and following, just a few little portions of Durell's dissertation. He writes, after a hiatus in monographs being devoted to the topic, Francesca Stavrakopoulou's King Manasseh and Child Sacrifice, Biblical Distortions of Historical Realities, devotes a significant portion of its attention to the MLK ritual. As the book's subtitle suggests, Stavrakopoulou is particularly concerned with the way in which the theological and ideological tendencies of the biblical writers has obscured the historical events and persons portrayed in their accounts. In the first half of her study, she focuses on the relationship between the biblical Manasseh and the historical Manasseh, concluding that the, quote, the portrayal of Manasseh within the text reveals not a portrait but a caricature, unquote. That's Stavrakopoulou's assessment. Significant for the purpose of this study, Durell writes, is when Stavrakopoulou turns her critical lens to child sacrifice rituals, attempting to determine how accurately the biblical depiction of these rites matches historical reality. She begins by rejecting the suggestion of Weinfeld and others that the relevant texts actually refer to dedicatory rites. She points out that Ezekiel and Jeremiah, among others, explicitly state that children were killed as part of the ritual, which rules out understanding the ritual as involving anything other than sacrifice. While some of the terminology used in connection with child sacrifice might be ambiguous as to the nature of the rite, others, and he's listing a few Hebrew verbs here, Others are clearly incompatible with Weinfeld's dedicatory hypothesis. So let me intrude here. I think this is a correct assessment. I think Stavrakopoulou is right on this point. You can't really just go with Weinfeld saying it's a baby dedication.
Okay.
Where they're just sort of waving the kid through flames or walking through flame. You know, she's right here. I mean, there are certain passages where it's very clear that the infant was killed. So I think she makes a good point there. Stavrakopoulou then, this is back to Durell's dissertation, Stavrakopoulou then examines the way in which the ritual is depicted in the Hebrew Bible. The first thing that she notes is that the rite is often described as foreign to Israel. Deuteronomy 12, 29 through 31, for example, accuses the nations whom Yahweh had driven out of the land of sacrificing their sons and daughters. She notes, quote, "The practice of child sacrifice is thus condemned, not because it is ethically untenable, but because it is foreign," unquote. Now, let me just stop there. That's really gratuitous on her part. That assumes that the only reason an Israelite would not want to do something is because some other nation's doing it. Like there's no other moral basis for not doing a practice than that one question. Do the nations do it? You know, that's really gratuitous. But again, that I think that reflects, I think it's not only a false dichotomy, but I think it sort of reflects her orientation, you know, in terms of her attitude toward the biblical material. In essence, the Hebrew Bible, this is back to Durell, in essence, the Hebrew Bible depicts the practice of child sacrifice as restricted to foreigners, like Mesha and the Sepharvites, the Judahites, who rejected Yahweh and chose to serve foreign deities like Ahaz and Manasseh. This is not a depiction that Stavrakopoulou is willing to take at face value, obviously. Durell continues, she begins by exploring the implications of the law of the firstborn. Again, this is where we started our episode, Exodus 13. A discussion of the conclusions that she draws will appear below, but it is worth noting here that she views it as evidence that child sacrifice at one time played a prominent role in the Yahwistic cult. With regard to the nature of biblical MLK, Stavrakopoulou sides with Eisfeld in viewing the word as a sacrificial term rather than as a divine name or epithet. Addressing the most cogent objection to Eisfeld's thesis, which is Leviticus 25, which refers to, quote, whoring after the MLK, a phrase that otherwise always refers to a supernatural being or an image, you know, an idol associated with such a being, and never to a type of sacrifice, Stavrakopoulou recognizes this difficulty for her thesis and presents several solutions to it. Now, again, at this point, Durell in his dissertation, he goes through the options. And I mean, you know, the question is, well, are any of her comebacks at all satisfactory here? Because she wants, again, what is she trying to do? She's trying to say this is not the name of a deity because she doesn't want the practice of child sacrifice to originate outside Israel. She wants it to be part of the original Israelite Orthodox worship of Yahweh. Now, I don't know if Stavrakopoulou is motivated by her atheism. She is an atheist. I know one student who's a dissertator under her, and he's apparently having a good experience. I mean, nothing, you know, personal about her here, but I just have to wonder if she doesn't have some kind of axe to grind. So, you know, she recognizes this problem to her thesis that everywhere else this syntactical construction refers to a deity name and not to a particular sacrifice. And so she offers a few possible comebacks, you know, to this problem. I think only one of them is really worth mentioning, that, you know, you might have a point here, you know. So back to Durell, you know, he's going through these, and this is one of them. He writes, it is possible that Ha-Molech, and it's vocalized there, so the Ha definite article plus the MLK, refers not to the ritual but to the sacrificial victim himself, not the deity. Remember, she doesn't want to say it's a deity from the outside. She's saying, well, maybe the MLK doesn't refer to a ritual, but it refers to the victim. Thus, the Hebrew phrase to whore after the MLK would be referring to whoring after the MLK offerings and not the deity. Well, that, is she trying to say, now she doesn't say this, but is she trying to say that they were whoring after these things because they just liked to kill people? Maybe they didn't like the victims. They just wanted to see certain people be victims. I don't really know where she's going with this, but to me, that doesn't undermine the syntactical problem her view is facing. She's still trying to make it about the offering. And she says, well, the victim, you know, that could be viewed sort of as a proper. No, look, you know, again, I don't really know what her angle is here, but it doesn't feel too effective. But this is probably the best of the ones that Durell goes through. The other ones just are worse. Okay. Back to Durell. Finally, she notes that the fact that MLK offerings were mentioned in conjunction with ancestral gods, the Ovote, we've talked about the Ovote here on the podcast before, the Ha-Ovote and the Knowers, the Ha-Yideh, the knowing ones, okay? And she cites Leviticus 20 through verses 2 through 5. So again, she says, well, the Ovote and the knowing ones appear to have played a role in divinatory practice, as does the MLK offering. That might be why people are doing it. Again, that doesn't help her case. That doesn't help her get away necessarily from the outside origin. Because, number one, the Ovote and the knowing ones are still entities. Of course you would do this in a divinatory ritual, because it's the entities on the other side that you presume have knowledge that you want, or that you want to placate them. So, okay, it's not about Molech. It's about some other entities. What's the point? I mean, really, what's the point? Because those practices specifically are condemned in the Hebrew Bible because they are offerings, sacrifices to other deities. So, I don't know, again, how she thinks this works, but I'm just saying it really doesn't. It doesn't get her far enough away from the thing that she's trying to get away from in making this argument. Now, back to Durell. Stavrakopoulou does not attempt to demonstrate that any of these options, and I've only hit a couple here. She doesn't try to demonstrate that any of these options is the correct one, but she concludes that there's enough reason to doubt that the verse absolutely precludes an understanding of MLK as a type of offering rather than the full name of a deity. You know, if I was on her dissertation committee, I would say, you just have not made that case. Because these are still entities. It doesn't matter that it's a deity name. They're still deities. Even if Ovote and the knowing ones, you know, the Yidaoni, aren't proper names, they're still entities. So you really haven't gotten away from this very far, you know, and again, the other issue about, you know, whoring after the victim, I don't know what the point is there. So if I was her advisor for her dissertation, I would have said, man, it's not like I'm going to flunk you or anything, because, you know, you don't do that sort of thing unless you're a jerk. But I'd say, this just really isn't satisfying. It's just not cutting it. Anyway. You know, the issue for Stavrakopoulou is that she takes the law of the firstborn as being a viable option for people in early Israel. This is really what she's trying to go after. And so when Durell sort of gets around his own assessment of what she's trying to do, let me just, you know, quote a little bit more from him, then we'll be done, you know, with the dissertation. We're almost actually, you know, we're close to wrapping up here anyway, because this is kind of the point I wanted to angle for, you know, the recent work. Even if you can't pronounce Stavrakopoulou, you'll see her name on the internet, because again, her name gets picked up, you know, as a biblical scholar who's into this topic, and she has an axe to grind. Okay, she thinks that the prohibitions of this are just propaganda. She operates with a hermeneutic of suspicion. That's what she's doing. But Durell, again, let's just go back to him to wrap up. This does not mean, Durell says, that Stavrakopoulou believes there were some groups who adhered to a law that called for the general sacrifice of firstborn children and others do not. He's talking about how she says it's an option. Instead, she agrees with DeVoe that firstborn sacrifice is unlikely. So she actually agrees with DeVoe that, yeah, it's unlikely this was institutionalized. It's unlikely to have been generally practiced even by an isolated group, although she disagrees with his conclusion that the laws that seem to command precisely that must mean something different. Instead, she argues that DeVoe misunderstands the nature of the biblical laws, which is a real mouthful. I mean, Roland DeVoe had real high status as a biblical scholar, and you got to have more than what you have to just dismiss DeVoe. Like, he just doesn't get it. So that, again, that that would leave me a little dissatisfied as well. Now, in his Exodus commentary, Prop, this is Durell again, pointing out that Prop, the Exodus commentary in the Anchor Yale Bible series, also argues against interpreting Exodus 22, 28, and 29, and some of these other passages as indicating that firstborn children were ever regularly offered by Israelite Yahweh. So again, DeVoe and Prop, they're not evangelicals. I think that's important to point out. This is mainstream biblical scholarship. Again, the people who are like Stavrakopoulou, you know, they're on the periphery of this issue, thinking that it was institutionalized. And again, to be fair to Stavrakopoulou, she does back off of that a little bit and says, well, maybe it was an option. You know, they could kill the kid if they want. If not, they could redeem it, you know, later on. But initially, she would be firm here. Initially, the beginning of the worship of Yahweh, child sacrifice was a normal institution. You know, she would say that. But DeVoe disagreed with that. Prop disagreed with that. You know, others, of course, have disagreed with that. You know, Prop has kind of a funny line in here in his Exodus commentary. He points to really the absurd logic of this. He refers to an institutionalized child sacrifice as being Darwinian suicide on the part of Israelites, which, yeah, I mean, if everybody's doing this, that's kind of going to hurt the population. You know, how would you explain, again, the expansion of the population? Again, somebody like Stavrakopoulou could just come along and say, but the Bible's full of it. You know, their population didn't expand. They struggled, you know, until they reached enlightenment. Maybe this was their point of enlightenment. Hey, you know, our population's not growing. You know, we're heading into demographic winter here. We better stop this. Again, it's just speculation. Now, Durell winds up this way. He says, those who argue that the plain sense of Deuteronomy 22, 28, and 29, along with Exodus 13, 1 and 2. Okay, if you view those as originally separate from verses 11 through 16, so if you're one that says verses 11 through 16 were added later, and all you've got is Exodus 13, 1 and 2, and Exodus 22, 28, 9, well, you know, then, yeah, you know, you'd have to read those verses, and there'd be no reason to not conclude that Yahweh was asking for child sacrifice. Because when you eliminate the redemption part of the passage, what else do you have? I mean, it would be easy to read it that way. So Durell's saying, yeah, you know, if you take that stuff out, well then, yeah, that's what you'd have. And then he says, further, the fact that animals are said to be offered in the same way makes it highly unlikely that firstborn children are intended to be dedicated to temple service rather than sacrifice. And here I'll break in and say, Durell misses the verse 13, because there is an exemption that applies to firstborn donkeys. And he, you know, yes, I know he's saying, you know, if you add the verses 11 through 16 later and you just, you know, you don't even look at that. I agree. If you're not looking at those verses, then yeah, how else would you read these passages? But then he tries to make part of the argument on the redemption idea, which is in those verses. And he misses the firstborn donkey thing, which, as I said earlier, really messes up the logic. What? The prophets were so offended by firstborn donkey sacrifice, they had to put in a redemption clause here? Again, it's kind of silly. Durell says, despite the plain sense of the text, however, scholars are right to question how the obvious reading can be the correct one, given the overwhelming evidence that firstborn children were not regularly sacrificed. While a full diachronic examination will have to wait until the following chapters, he does that in his dissertation. It is worth noting that there is no indication in any of the copious narrative material of the Hebrew Bible that firstborn children were ever regularly sacrificed by the Israelites or their neighbors. The cases of child sacrifice that do appear are all during extraordinary circumstances. The sole exception is Ezekiel 20 and verse 25, which appears to imply that at least some Israelites were interpreting some law as demanding a child sacrifice. Ezekiel 20:25 says, moreover, I gave them statutes that were not good and rules by which they could not have life, and defiled them through their very gifts and their offering of all their firstborn, that I might devastate them. Again, you know, does that refer to the animals? Does it refer to people? Or is it just a terrible interpretation of a law like Exodus 13, 1 and 2? Now, we don't really know. Ezekiel's not that specific. Now, I would agree with Durell in this respect. The absence of evidence for the practice, you know, the institutionalized practice of child sacrifice argues pretty forcefully that the true worship of Yahweh did not include child sacrifice. you know, you got to have some positive evidence that they were doing this, that they were looking at the text the way Stavrakopoulou looks at it. Okay. You got to have something there, because if you don't, you have circular reasoning. That's what you have. At the end of the day, that is what you have. I would also agree with Prop that this is kind of a Darwinian national suicide sort of thing. And again, I would further go back to how this makes zero sense as a remembrance of the protection of the firstborn. That's its context. The Passover is the context for Exodus 13, 1 and 2, even without verses 11 through 16. You know, and again, I don't think there's any evidence that verses 11 through 16, you know, weren't there when verses 1 and 2 were written. Again, I think that's pure speculation. But even if they weren't there, think about it. Exodus 13, 1 through 2 come on the heels of Exodus 12, the protection of the firstborn at the Passover. So how in the world does it make any sense to say, hey, the Lord just protected our firstborn, now let's kill it, or he wants us to kill it now? Again, I think that's a logical absurdity, even without verses 11 through 16. Let me end by offering my own speculation here, though. I mean, see if again, I think, yeah, you know, I'm doing what these other, you know, people do on the other side of it. So yeah, this is just speculation, but I think this rings truer. I would suggest that there would have been people in Israel who thought that Exodus 13, 1 through 2, presuming they knew of it, and you know, they were just sort of ignorant about everything else. Maybe there's somebody in Israel that thought those verses gave them permission to sacrifice a child to Yahweh. Let's just say somebody would have just been that dense and would have done that. You know, sure, somebody could have used the verses we've talked about to justify the idea, presuming, again, incorrectly, that that was how Yahweh wanted to be worshipped. Sort of like, you know, how some people in Israelite history thought that other aberrant forms of worship were fine. Remember 2 Kings 23, 10 to 11, you have sun worship. You know, Josiah's reform, that's the same context, 2 Kings 23, you know. There were other people doing other things, thinking that it was okay worship of Yahweh, but they were wrong. You know, we might be generous and call these sorts of assumptions understandable, but they'd still be wrong. You know, maybe they looked at it or heard the verse, oh, okay, I could offer my kid, you know, and maybe that God will love me a little bit more. You know, again, this isn't good thinking, but you could see where somebody would think this way. You know, again, we might be generous and just say, well, they were just kind of clueless. They weren't evil, but they were clueless or something like that. But if the verses were evident, there'd have been an institutionalized child sacrifice. And you'd think there would be either textual or archaeological evidence in Israel for that. And there is neither. I would say it's sort of similar to how some Christians today, people who embrace the work of the cross and they don't believe there's another way of salvation, I mean, they're really Christians. They might use Exodus 21, 22 through 25 to justify abortion. Okay, let me just read the passage to you. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, and there is no harm, but the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judge is determined. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. So the idea here, again, in some, you know, quote-unquote, I hate the term, progressive Christians, legitimize abortion on the basis of this passage. They again, it's going to sound a little bizarre maybe to some of you, but some of you may have come across this, but they'll make the passage say that you only have the eye for eye, the death penalty offense, if the woman is killed. But if the kids die, you know, they come out and they presume that they're stillborn or something, then you don't have the death penalty. And so that means that the child, the fetus, was not viewed as human, whereas the woman was. So we can, you know, abortion's okay. You know, maybe there are Christians, and I know there are Christians today, that would look at that passage, interpret it that way, and justify an abortion. They would be wrong as well, just like our hypothetical person in Israel that looks at Exodus 13, 1 through 2 and says, oh, okay, I can sacrifice my kid. Okay, yeah, you could see how people can reach a conclusion, but they'd still be wrong. And we know in the instance of Exodus 21, 22 through 25, the abortion passage, We know that they're wrong for certain, because when we juxtapose that passage to the very similar legislation in Hammurabi's law, we learn that the difference in fines, difference in penalties, is about social class, not something is human versus not human. So we need to get it in our heads that just because an Israelite, or maybe a bunch of Israelites, had a thought, just because they have a thought, doesn't mean the thought was correct. And it also doesn't mean that it was an institution, an institutionalized thought. Lots of people in ancient Israel, another example, thought Yahweh had a consort, a wife, Asherah. We know that's the case from sites and inscriptions like Kuntalet Ashrud and Kerbet Elkom, where you have a reference to Yahweh and his Asherah. Okay, some Israelite out there somewhere in the boonies, okay, believe that. But going from that observation, somebody thought that way, to saying that Orthodox Yahwism included the idea Yahweh had a wife, that's flawed. That's flawed reasoning. There's no evidence in the Hebrew Bible that this was the case and that it was institutionalized. It's only when the hermeneutic of suspicion is applied do we see such arguments arise. And their conclusions are non sequiturs. They go like this. Well, let's take the Asherah one. Well, the prophets rail against Asherah, so that must mean Asherah used to be Yahweh's wife. And that was okay until the prophets. That's a non sequitur. I hearken back once again, you've heard me mention this before, to the day in my doctoral seminar at Wisconsin when I said it would be a good idea if a logic course was required of all doctoral students in biblical studies. Okay, I didn't win hearts and minds that day, but I meant it then, and I mean it now. Okay, clear thinking is kind of important. So with respect to Exodus 13, what we're left with is the biblical data as they stand versus speculative moving parts of passages around chronologically to accommodate a hermeneutic of suspicion that wants to take the condemnations of child sacrifice as indicating a former allowed practice, and then use the moving of those passages around as a proof. It's circular reasoning, and it's a self-serving approach.
All right, Mike. Well, are we finally to the Red Sea? Can we cross it now? Are we close?
Can we cross the Red Sea?
Can we cross it now?
Yep. We're going to get into the itinerary. I'm going to loop the pillar of cloud and fire in Exodus 13 into 14, and that's the crossing. So, yep, we're going to get in there.
Okay, and you're also going to touch on the unleavened bread again. Is that correct?
Yeah, we'll come back to that at some point. Pick it up when it's discussed, you know, a bit later when we get to some of the feasts and whatnot. We'll loop it back in.
All right, so we're not quite done with 13, but hey, we're to the Red Sea. We're about to cross it. So all right.
Yeah, yeah. We're not being chased by Pharaoh here, but we want to move on.
All right, sounds good, Mike. Looking forward to it. All right. Just want to make sure everybody out there leaves us a review and rates us on iTunes, wherever you consume us, and help us out. We greatly appreciate that. And I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.